Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, Mr. Wizard, what's cooking?
In other words, the heat from the candle goes through the paper and is pulled away so fast by the metal bar that it keeps the paper from burning because it can't get up to the high enough temperature?
True.
You think that's true?
It's true that there's plenty of science and chemistry in cooking, but when chefs get down to actually arranging the molecules on your plate, it can get pretty extreme. Pass the reactor, Dr. Frankenstein. Let's eat. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
It's Wednesday, October 29th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, we're covering politics in the final days of the race, plus some perspective on the economic situation in a talk with a Dust Bowl historian. And we're going to get to all of that as soon as I've had my liquid nitrogen-cooled coffee.
That sounds yummy. Sounds very, very cold. Good morning, everyone. There's less than a week to go before this seemingly endless election actually ends and the candidates are making their final pitches on the air and in the flesh.
It's wonderful to be back in Pennsylvania, and it's wonderful to fool the pundits, because we're going to win the state of Pennsylvania, my friends. We're going to win it on November 4th.
Trying to fool all of the pundits all of the time. We will see about that. But John McCain's trip to Hershey yesterday had an immediate impact on puns. Media coverage of his speech was a gooey mess of bad references to chocolate. Barack Obama's rhetoric generally steers clear of bad puns, but yesterday's metaphor, well, you listen and decide.
John McCain's ridden shotgun as George Bush has driven our economy towards a cliff. And now he wants to take the wheel and step on the gas.
Trying to work out the physics of how you take the wheel and step on the gas from the passenger seat, Obama seems to assume Republicans drive very small cars.
We'll see if Obama refines the line today when he campaigns in North Carolina and Florida. McCain is also talking to voters in Florida. That's what they call retail politics. Wholesale politics include TV ads, and tonight an infomercial. Obama spent millions to run a 30-minute ad on most major networks tonight. It's a TV roadblock. The ad will be on several networks at once in prime time.
But watchers of Top Chef, I don't think, have to worry. A mixed day at world markets so far after a gusher yesterday on Wall Street. Futures trading on U.S. indices point to a flat opening. It's turned slightly positive in the last hour. It was a wild ride up yesterday. The Dow gained 11% to close at 90.65, the second biggest point gain on record. And the S&P was also up 11%, ending at 940. There are many dead and thousands homeless and whole towns practically destroyed in Pakistan after a devastating 6.4 magnitude earthquake rocked the southwest of the country. Local leaders say they're running low on food, medicine, and shelter for all of those who lost their homes.
Game 5 of the World Series is set for tonight. It's really more like, I don't know, maybe game 5.5. Heavy rain forced the Tampa Bay Rays and Philadelphia Phillies to suspend the game earlier in the week. The Phillies lead the series 3-1, so they can win potentially.
The game is tied 2-2 in the sixth at this point. When it resumes, weather permitting, we shall see. 1 week from now, the election will be over. We'll all be looking back at the campaign that was. But we want a slogan that's going to define this last 18 months, 2 years of campaigning. In one sentence or a phrase, how would you sum up the race? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're following details as they emerge from the devastation in Pakistan from a 6.4 earthquake that occurred there this morning. But we begin with the campaign. It's less than a week away from the presidential final vote. The presidential campaign is almost over, but the polls are open. And stopping by America's exit poll this morning is Sarah Awad, who is a 19-year-old college student at Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
And
thank you.
Tom Chapelier joins us from Omaha, Nebraska. Tom, thanks for being here.
You bet. Thank you.
Now, both of these folks are early voters. Sarah, when did you vote?
I voted about the second day I was allowed to vote.
So that's about a week ago?
Yeah.
Something like that. All right. What was it like to go in and early vote, and why did you decide to early vote?
Well, I pretty much decided to early vote on a whim. I was walking on campus, and they stopped me and told me, did you know you could early vote today? And they actually drove me from campus to where I could go vote.
So you were essentially kidnapped and taken to a polling place to vote, right?
In so many words.
Tom Chapelier, how about you? What was the voting scene like for you in Omaha?
Well, the voting scene was pretty relaxed. There was probably about 15 people coming in every 10 minutes or so and walking through and voting. When I voted about 2 weeks ago. There was no lines, so it was fairly quick. I understand this last week there's been longer lines.
Now, according to the ABC News Washington Post tracking poll, we already have a 9% turnout of early voters. So you're part of the 9% of Americans who've already cast their ballot, and it's expected that 34% of likely voters are going to vote early. Why did you vote early, Tom?
Well, I voted early. I got in the habit of a few cycles ago because the early voting location was a couple blocks away from my office. And so I just made it a habit of going voting then, get it done, get it over with.
So you're an organized, responsible sort of kind of guy who really makes sure that your life runs smoothly.
A lot of people would be surprised at that statement, yes.
Yes, I see, I see. Well, unlike Sarah, who, of course, got kidnapped there off the campus of Ohio State University. So, Sarah, who'd you vote for?
Obama.
And Tom Chapelier, who'd you vote for?
I voted for John McCain.
Now, were you the minority or part of the majority in your Omaha early voting precinct, Tom?
I don't know. I suspect it was probably split down the middle.
How about you, Sarah?
Probably split down the middle.
Split down the middle. Interesting. Well, thanks so much for being a part of America's Exit Poll. Would you sum up the campaign? Could you give us a slogan for the campaign, Sarah? 2 years of blank?
I have no idea. I guess it's been a grueling campaign so far.
Grueling campaign. Tom, would you give us a slogan for the campaign off the top of your head?
2 years of endless slogans.
2 years of endless slogans. Fabulous. Tom Chapelier and Sarah Awad, part of America's Exit Poll, voting in Omaha, Nebraska there. That's where Tom was. And Sarah Awad voting at Ohio State in Columbus, Ohio. Adora?
And while Americans continue to vote, Democratic and Republican leaders, well, they all have their eyes glued to three southern states, Georgia, Mississippi, and Kentucky. Senate races in those three states are likely to decide whether Democrats get a 60-seat filibuster-proof majority. Aaron Blake joins us for the story. He's a staff writer for The Hill and has been traveling in the South. Yesterday, he was in Mississippi. And Aaron, today, where are you?
I'm actually between Mississippi and Georgia in Montgomery, Alabama.
And why are these races so important in these three states?
Well, I think when you look at these races, these three races in particular are probably the ones that are going to decide whether Democrats get to 60. There's a group of about five or six other races that are a little bit higher on the totem pole for Democrats, a little bit easier for them to win. But if they do get those seats, we're going to be looking at these three races to see whether or not they can get the nine seats that they need in order to get to 60 votes and a filibuster-proof majority.
Let's talk about the race in Mississippi since you were just there. And the latest polls show the Republican wicker up 11 points.
Yeah, that's a little bit of an outlier so far. Most of the polling we've been seeing on this race shows the race within the margin of error. And this poll had a lot more undecideds. I think we even asked Senator Wicker about it, and he said that he didn't believe it, which is a little bit unusual for somebody to say. But I think that that poll is a little bit of an outlier, and we're expecting a very close race in this state.
So that's Republican Roger Wicker versus Democrat Ronnie Musgrove. And how would you describe that race?
Well, you've got two candidates who are very ideologically similar. Ronnie Musgrove is a former governor. He's a conservative Democrat, a Mississippi Democrat is how he terms himself. So you're seeing Roger Wicker try to kind of nationalize this race and attach Ronnie Musgrove to the National Party, say that he's going to help these liberal interest groups pass their agenda in the Senate. So we've seen the race kind of be run along those lines in the last few days here, and so the 60-seat filibuster-proof majority is definitely coming into play.
And, Aaron, Democrats certainly have reason to be optimistic there in Mississippi, given the recent elections for the House of Representatives.
Yes, this was a big race several months back. Mississippi was one of three races where Democrats won a Republican-held seat in a special election in the House. This one in Mississippi was probably the most unexpected. It was the most conservative district. Congressman Travis Childers now represents the first district in that state and is favored to win re-election. So that was the kind of the turning point of the election where we started to think, you know, Democrats won a lot of seats last cycle, and it looks like they're going to do so again.
And let's talk about the Kentucky race, where you have Senate Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell fighting hard for his sixth term, and certainly unexpectedly.
Yes, this is another race that if you looked at it at the beginning of the cycle, you probably wouldn't say that Mitch McConnell would be in trouble. Democrats recruited somebody who's run statewide before, a man who has some money that he can put in the race himself, in Bruce Lunsford, and they've made a race out of it. Now, this is a big race because obviously Democrats want to win another seat, but also because Mitch McConnell is the Republican leader in the Senate. And Republicans 4 years ago knocked off the Democratic leader, Tom Daschle, from South Dakota. So this race is personal as well as business for Democrats, and I think that the leadership in the Democratic Party has had their eye on making this a race throughout the entire cycle.
Aaron, give us a feel, some of the flavor of how the 60-seat filibuster-proof majority for Democrats is actually a campaign issue. Do the candidates actually say, if you vote me down, the Democrats will, you know, become supreme leaders and will assume dictatorial powers on Capitol Hill, and are voters buying it?
Well, this is what we're starting to see, you know, a little bit from John McCain. I don't know that he talks about the filibuster more so than just the party balance. But Senator Wicker is definitely talking about the filibuster. I asked several people, you know, is this something that it translates to voters? Do people know what a filibuster is and what the significance of 60 seat is? Well, the Republican mayor of Biloxi in Mississippi was even skeptical that his, you know, a candidate he supported was using a really good strategy by saying this. But, you know, I think that they make a decent point when they say, well, they might not understand the filibuster, but they do understand what party balance is and what happens when one party gets too much control, especially a national party with which you may disagree. So I think that's kind of what it boils down to. But when you start dealing with that strategy, you're also not talking about the things that you believe in. You're talking about the things that are on the national scene. So I think it gets muddled a little bit.
Before we go, let's look at the Georgia race, where Saxby Chambliss is in a tight race with Democrat Jim Martin. And how would you is there a way to sum up all three? Is it the economy?
I think that that definitely plays a role. You see states like Georgia and Kentucky and Mississippi are highly rural. So, you know, some of these areas weren't doing so great to begin with and now might be struggling more. I also just think it's a matter of Democrats having recruited some very appropriate candidates for these races. You've got candidates who aren't traditional Democrats. They're pragmatically recruited. They have some socially conservative views that basically allow them to be acceptable to voters in these areas. Now, once they start governing, if they get to the Senate, it might be a different issue. But at least right now, they fit their states.
Aaron Blank, thank you. Staff writer for The Hill, thanks so much for joining us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Exactly a week from now, we'll all be asking ourselves the question, what just happened? The dust will be settling from the 2 years of campaigning, and we want you to come up with a slogan that will define this epic in American history.
Paul from Rhode Island, the tortoise and the tortoise.
Tell us in one sentence or phrase how you sum up this historic race for the presidency. Let us know at 877-8-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
John, we turn now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where rebel fighters today say they have taken control of a town in a crucial strategic area as fighting continues between government troops and the rebels loyal to the renegade General Laurent Nkunda. Tens of thousands of people have been fleeing the violence. Some are accusing the UN and its troops on the ground there of not doing enough. The Congolese government accuses Rwanda of backing the rebels, which the Rwandans deny. Joining us now is BBC World Affairs correspondent Mark Doyle. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Hi, morning.
What's the latest of what's happening today?
Well, the latest situation is a continuation of what's been going on for several days now. The rebels of Laurent Nkunda, who you mentioned, appear to be trying to take the regional capital of eastern Congo, which is a place called Goma. They appear to be doing this for two essential reasons, really. I think they've perceived a weakness in the government forces, and they've also perceived a weakness in the United Nations forces who fight with the government, because the government is an elected government and therefore the UN recognizes it, and the UN peacekeepers have a sort of role of helping the government forces. They're not just peacekeepers in between the two. And the background to this is two things, really. One is the tension, ethnic tension, between ethnic Tutsis on both the Congolese and Rwandan sides of the border, and ethnic Hutus on both sides also. So there's a sort of proxy war going on between Rwanda and Congo. But it's not just about ethnicity, it's also about illegal mining of minerals. In this area you find a compound called coltan, which is used in all of our mobile phones, actually, a tiny amount of it, so we all carry around a bit of Congo in our pocket. And that's very valuable, and all of the fighting forces have been illegally mining this stuff.
And it's a conflict commodity, right? I mean, it's a kind of thing that contributes to the wealth of a region like the Congo, but also contributes to its instability, coltan.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a bit like some of your listeners may have heard of blood diamonds, because there's been a bit of a campaign to try and stop diamonds fueling wars in Africa and elsewhere, because it's so easy to pocket them, and they're such a concentrated form of wealth. Now, coltan is a very, very similar thing. It looks, if you see it, it looks like sort of just mud, really. But when it's been refined down, it's extremely valuable. And a lot of the wars in eastern Congo are either over coltan or diamonds or other important minerals in the area.
Let's talk about what the tipping point has been here. You're saying that this is the third day of fighting, and there are 17,000 UN troops that are on the ground there. What triggered the beginning of this?
Well, it's difficult to know. I've been talking to some Congolese experts about this, and they speculate there's a couple of things. First of all, that the government in Kinshasa, that's the capital of Congo, which is a very long way away from where this fighting is taking place. It's such a huge country. But anyway, the government in Kinshasa is perceived to be relatively weak at the moment. They've just replaced the prime minister. And maybe these rebels saw an opportunity to exploit that weakness and try and take some extra land. The other possibility is that the rebels thought that the world might be busy with all of its financial crises and the election that you've got over there on that side of the pond, and they thought that the world would not notice.
And how many people, do you have any sense, have been displaced since the fighting began? How many people, how many casualties?
Yes, certainly. In the last few days, approximately 30,000 people have been displaced. But in the last few months, about 200,000 people have been displaced. And if you take the province of North Kivu, which is this area where the fighting is taking place, it's a huge area. It's about the size of Belgium. Well, I don't know if that sounds very big to the United States audience, but it's a big, big area by any standards. Number of people displaced there is estimated to be about 1 million people in the last few years have been displaced. So if this was happening even in a medium-sized country, you'd think it was a huge thing, but this is just one corner of the problems that they have in Congo.
There's been some calls for more UN troops to head to the Congo. Do you think that's likely to happen, and have there been formal requests made by the Congolese government?
Well, it was interesting that last night in New York, actually, the head of the UN mission to Congo is a British diplomat called Alan Doss, did a video link with journalists at the United Nations headquarters in New York. He was speaking in Kinshasa, the Congolese capital. And he did a sort of different variation on the send more troops, please, which is what most UN commanders and generals do. He said, send any troops. I don't mind if they're UN troops. Any troops will do. We are really at the edge of what we can cope with. And following that, the French ambassador, interestingly, said that it was obvious that the UN force needed to be beefed up. And the French do have previous on this affair. They did send troops to another part of Congo, Ituri province, when that got completely out of hand, and they briefly sent some troops, not as United Nations troops, but sort of working alongside the United Nations. So if I had to bet money on it, I would bet that the French will be sending a few hundred soldiers, which could make the difference. The problem is that France has a deep and complicated colonial relationship with this part of Africa, and a number of countries, notably Rwanda, which is a small but very powerful country in this part of the world, would be most unhappy, I think, unless the French cleared it with them beforehand, that the French troops went there.
Mark Doyle, thanks very much for that update on the Congo. Mark Doyle is a BBC World Affairs correspondent. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who's got some more headlines for us.
Thank you very much, Dora. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. With markets set to open in just over an hour, Wall Street futures are down a bit after yesterday's big rally. A powerful 6.4 magnitude earthquake has struck southwest Pakistan near the city of Quetta. At least 160 people were killed in the quake. Our partners at the BBC spoke earlier to one of the survivors.
When the earthquake occurred, I was sleeping in my house with my children, and suddenly I heard a noise, and I recognized it was an earthquake. I ran to get my children. The window broke and my hand was injured, and now I'm waiting with my children on the roadside.
I've been looking at some of the early footage we've been getting from that earthquake and some of the landslides that have also happened. People actually picking up large rocks and boulders trying to get to people buried underneath the earthquake. Some early reports say that entire villages have been wiped out. Relief workers are still trying to get to the quake-hit areas. Pakistan's foreign ministry has called for an end to US missile strikes in its border region. They say the attacks violate its sovereignty and provoke extremists. And Game 5 of the World Series may pick up again tonight if the weather breaks. It will actually be Game 5 Part 2. The players were forced to stop play in the middle of the sixth inning on Monday because of rain. The Philadelphia Phillies lead the Tampa Bay Rays 3-1. The game will be on Fox, who will delay it by about 15 minutes for Obama's infomercial. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Gather around.
What you doing,
Gather
John?
Around. There are martini glasses in the studio this morning, which means that Julia Moskin is with us, New York Times food editor and writer. There is science and there is cooking, okay? I mean, there's plenty of chemistry involved in how you eat and what you eat and how you prepare what you eat. But there's this wacky new area. It's been around for a little while, where the two intersect in a kind of molecular way. Famous chefs have immersed themselves in molecular gastronomy to create edible menus and freeze-dried soup. Now the scientists, with their lab equipment in tow, are coming into the kitchen and taking their turn at the stove. New York Times food writer Julia Moskis is here with us. What have you got bubbling
over
there?
I know, I can hear. What is that?
Well, that's a dry ice martini in the process of sublimating. Dry ice is much colder than regular ice, of course. It freezes at about 109 degrees below zero. So, and it turns directly from a solid into a gas.
That's the sublimation part, right?
That's what sublimation is, and that removes that terrible nightmare when your ice cubes have melted in your drink, and now it's diluted. Ah. And so the scientists took the application of dry ice to create martinis that remain cold. In fact, they're much colder than regular martinis, and they never get diluted.
Well, let's let that sublimate for a moment and talk about this movement in restaurants around the country. I mean, cooks are actually using techniques for manipulating molecules, not just chemical elements, to create dishes. Give me some examples.
Absolutely. And this is an example, actually, of a movement that is not just around the country, but really very international, with Ferran Adrià working in Spain and Heston Blumenthal in England being really sort of the leaders of the movement. Those are projects that chefs do that have a lot to do with refining flavor, with changing texture, with concentrating, like creating a very concentrated puree of tomato, and then using a syringe to insert it into a ball of mozzarella, which naturally has these stretchy properties. So they'll create something like that, like a bead of mozzarella, rose-scented mozzarella cheese. They'll create an Oreo cookie out of black olives. So that's really about creating a particular flavor experience on the plate at a very high level, very refined. These meals cost hundreds, if not thousands of dollars.
Thousands?
Thousands, absolutely.
Well, again, a concrete example. How do you make a hyper-concentrated sauce with chemical tactics versus simply a reduction where you're causing the water to evaporate from a pan and it thickens that way?
Those chefs use a lot of the lessons from the food industry, which is very interesting. They use a lot of stabilizers such as soy lecithin, gelatinizers like agar agar. There's a company, National Starch, that makes literally hundreds of different kinds of starches that these guys tend to play with in their kitchens. In fact, El Bulli, a restaurant in Spain, is only open half the year so that the chef can spend the rest of the year working in his laboratory. In Barcelona.
I wonder what his mistakes taste like. So why would you want to have your food conduct electricity?
Well, then at the other end of the spectrum, where there are no restaurants, not any money to be made that I can discern, but actually professional scientists and amateurs who are really part of this sort of do-it-yourself curiosity craft hobby movement, who just want to see, for example, if you would be able to create a circuit, a working electrical circuit, that would be strong enough to cook hot dogs by electrocution, where you could just put a metal fork at the end of each, at each end of the hot dog.
And zap it.
Zap it, see if it works.
But Twizzlers actually conduct electricity if you dip them or anodize them with silver?
Yeah.
Who's done that?
A mechanical engineer called Patrick Buckley, who has just published a book called The Hungry Scientist Cookbook, wanted to create an edible electrical circuit in order to use LEDs to light a birthday cake rather than candles.
It just sounds like an oxymoron. Food and electricity.
Sound delicious.
I know. Can you actually eat that? You know, has he succeeded?
He has succeeded. I would have to say that deliciousness is not the goal.
Right.
Their flavor is a factor, because in trying to create this edible circuit, they did work out a way to make frosting out of electrode gel, which is what you would have smeared on
Yum.
Your skin.
Yum. Well, what?
But that tasted, that the flavor of that was rejected. They also made some out of Gatorade that didn't work out.
Now, everybody knows that a cake in the shape of a dodecahedron tastes much better than a regular old cylinder, right? How is geometry brought into the...
Geometry is really one of the ways, one of the things that separates the science guys from the chefs, because the chefs are not that interested in geometry. The science guys are very interested in patterns called fractals and how they can be created in edible forms. Fractals are patterns that are endlessly iterative, which means that it's just repeated larger and larger. So a little piece of something, like as in a fern, one leaf of it has exactly the same shape as the whole plant.
It's scalable. You can make surfaces that scale up for a whole plate, a platter, and down to a little, like, demitasse.
These scientists have made things like butter cookies in the shape of the Sierpinski carpet, which is a very elaborate nine-square pattern that is endlessly iterated in butter cookie dough.
Sierpinski carpet cookies. You know, take that morning edition. You're not going to hear Sierpinski cookies talked about in morning edition. All right, you got the martini ready? Let's go.
Yep.
Femi's here. She smelled there was martinis.
Okay.
Great. She's chunking the dry ice.
Now, when
there,
you're working with dry
up,
ice,
right? Okay.
You know, you'll hear that you can't touch it. You can't. You have to be really careful.
You just
but
did touch it.
Patrick Buckley, I watched while he poured liquid nitrogen literally over his hand to make some ice cream.
Now, you can't shake this. It'll actually explode.
Yeah, you can't shake it, and you can't close it because it might
explode. Please don't shake it.
So,
all right, here we go.
We're just stirring and
swirling. The carbon dioxide is coming out.
It's
looks like something
smoky.
From
and as you
young
can see,
Frankenstein.
It's very thick.
Wow.
Because it's so cold.
Interesting. It looks like syrup almost.
Yep. It has the texture of honey.
And
then
it's not going to. Oh, my goodness.
Put a couple of those in there. Those create something that looks
that'll
almost.
That'll keep it cold.
It looks like something from Harry Potter, right?
Well, this video is going to be on our website of this martini cooling down. And then when is it safe to drink?
After the dry ice has dissolved completely.
The martini is almost done. Julia Moskin, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks. It's a fascinating strand. A
martini with not olives, but dry ice in it. Julia Moskin, New York Times writer, writer on food. And Femi, okay, now could we have the headlines?
Yeah. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. September manufacturing orders post surprising increase, rising by largest amount since June. Credit card lenders are feeling the crunch from the bad economy. They've written off more than $21 billion in bad loans so far this year, with more likely to come. Now they're trying to cut costs, they're raising interest rates and reducing the number of direct mail offers. Suicide bombers have struck a UN compound and several other government buildings in the breakaway Republic of Somaliland. 19 people are dead so far. Fighting in eastern Congo is intensifying. Rebel forces have taken one town and have their eye on the region's capital, Goma. Tens of thousands of civilians have been driven from there since fighting began 3 days ago. And Arizona State University is showing that Senator McCain's lead in his home state of Arizona has almost disappeared. Senator McCain is leading Senator Obama by 2 points, which is down from a 7-point lead a month ago.
In Arizona?
In Arizona. And that's a look at your news for now.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And of course, a newspaper is a brand, right? It is a medium for disseminating information. It's also, we're told, a platform for supplying content. But before it was any of those, to me, a newspaper was an object. That's right. Something tangible you could touch and feel that made noise when you moved it. Newspapers once rubbed off on your fingers when folded and tossed onto a porch during a delivery boy's early morning route. Newspapers even made a smart-sounding thud.
The newspaper boy training program is sort of a symbol of America's system of free enterprise. And the benefits the boys derive from it are invaluable.
I was one of those boys. I used to deliver papers back in sixth grade a long time ago. And I would get up each morning to a heavy stack of papers, each of which needed to be folded or wrapped, and which represented the object at the center of the morning ritual of most of my neighbors back in Binghamton, New York, where I delivered the Sun Bulletin. The bulletin was kind of a silly paper with contests and puzzles on the front page, to the horror of my parents. For them, and for a lot of adults, newspapers were a high-minded affair. A proper newspaper was serious, like, say, the Christian Science Monitor.
On November 25th, 1908, the editorial page of Volume 1, Number 1, carried Mrs. Eddy's first signed editorial. In a brief paragraph, she stated her paper's objective: to injure no man, but to bless all mankind.
100 years ago, the Christian Science Monitor began publication with that high-minded editorial from Mary Baker Eddy, a church using its wealth and clout to challenge the wild fictions and pulpy columns from the presses of the Hearsts and the Pulitzers. For my birthday in 1966, my parents gave me a subscription to the Monitor, a subscription I paid for with money from delivering the Sun Bulletin. It was a remarkable present. The Monitor came every day in the mail. Each day, the history of the world, stories of places far away, came directly to me. My name was right there on the label. A torrent of information, a proper newspaper, and they accumulated in stacks.
The Monitor uses a battery of typesetting machines. Strange, intricate, electromechanical contrivances that transform molten lead into line upon line of type.
This documentary about the Christian Science Monitor was produced 50 years ago for the 50th anniversary of the paper. Each day after school, I would read the dispatches, or if I missed a day, the paper would still be there for me. I could just go back and live history.
Say, here's an exclusive from Cairo on a new proposal for a Middle Eastern settlement.
Is the United States involved? How solid is it?
It's very strong.
The paper, the object, was my vehicle, my window, my platform. Throwing away old papers was unthinkable. They were an archive with my name attached. Precious. Magical. That a church would create something like this seemed an astounding gift to an 11-year-old. My monitors were in my bedroom, stacked and tied, when I went off to college. Putting them out with the garbage the weekend before I went off to the dorms was a painful moment of attainment. The Christian Science Monitor announced yesterday that after a century of publication and seven Pulitzers, it would cease being a newspaper. Costs too high, circulation failing. The idea of a newspaper as an object, impossibly out of date in the internet era. Today, I'm reminded of that moment of closet cleaning when I went off to college so long ago, knowing that the papers would not come with me, but learning in that sad moment that the history and knowledge on their pages would never leave me. They're intangible, but they'd rubbed off on me. And they were indelible.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 29th. Femi Okeh has just joined us with the latest headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Wall Street opens in less than an hour. Futures trading indicates it will open flat, and that will be quite a contrast from yesterday when the Dow spiked 11%. The index racked up the second biggest one-day point gain in history. And all eyes will be on the Fed this afternoon. It's expected to cut interest rates. Hungary is the latest country to get a huge financial aid package. It's set to get more than $25 billion from the International Monetary Fund, EU and World Bank. Hungary has struggled as its currency has fallen almost 20%, but is recovering today on news of the major loans. Now, it's hard to believe. There's just 1 week to go before campaign 2008 is over. John McCain campaigns in Florida today. Barack Obama will be there too, as well as in North Carolina. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
So when the stock market had its historic crash 89 years ago today, the wild gyrations on Wall Street seemed far away from the farmers out on the prairie and other people who were settling in the American West. They were making money and putting the money in local banks where they thought it was safe. But in a wave, eventually the financial failures on Wall Street made their way to the prairie and the West. Banks failed, farms failed, and the Great Plains became the Dust Bowl.
I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues.
Timothy Egan writes the Outposts column for the New York Times. He's also the winner of the 2006 National Book Award for his history of people who lived through the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. The book is called The Worst Hard Time, and Timothy Egan spoke with us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, John.
You know, in your book, The Worst Hard Time, the beginning of the story actually has an eerie kind of echo for what's going on today, and that is that the farmers out in the Dust Bowl region, what became the Dust Bowl region, when they looked back at the headlines in New York about the financial crash, really felt as though there was no way that was going to affect them. And what they learned over the subsequent years after 1929 was that they were very, very wrong. Tell that story, will you?
Yeah, and there's a fascinating parallel to today. You hear some of the same complaints out west where I live, the same echoes from that time almost 80 years ago. Well, here's what happened. The 20s was this great gaudy era, as you know, when there was a 600% run-up in the stock market, and all these commodities out west, mainly wheat, dryland wheat, just went crazy. They doubled and tripled and quadrupled. And, you know, these folks, Wall Street crash, you know, late October 1929, we're in that anniversary right now of it. It went down on 2 days during the week, 11% one day, something like 12% the next, and at the end of the crash, it was a series of crashes, actually. The net result was Wall Street went down 40%. And folks said, well, this can't touch me, in large measure, because only 2% of all Americans owned any stock then. Now the figure is closer to 50%.
And the time, the farmers would say, we're dealing with land, something that's real, and wheat. People eat wheat. So, of course, it's real. It's not like paper money.
Exactly. They thought, you know, this stuff was air. This stuff was vapor in New York. And they sort of had this, I don't want to say arrogant, but they had this somewhat smug attitude that they were getting their biblical comeuppance, those Wall Street swells and all those gin-swilling city slickers who'd bet on paper, and here they owned something that was intangible. And the U.S. government had come out and said the soil is the one immutable thing that can never be lost. And so they had wheat, the staff of life, for God's sakes. So they didn't think this could ever touch them. But the reason it did was because once the commodities went up, it also went down. But more importantly, all these regional banks, we had thousands and thousands of regional banks which were chartered during the 1920s. These banks were unregulated. There was no FDIC. They were gambling in the stock market. So when Wall Street crashed, it took all the people's savings, all this money that people locked into these regional banks. And so you had just this panic, one after the other, banks closing in these little Norman Rockwell-like small towns. They would just close without notice, button up their doors, and people would come banging around and say, where's my money? And they'd say, it's gone. What do you mean it's gone? They'd say, well, we bet it on the stock market. And they didn't have ratios, you know, 10-to-1 ratios of having to keep their cash on hand. So this contagion quickly spread from something that should have been pretty isolated. In other words, again, only 2% of Americans own stock, to something that had touched the most basic and elemental of all things, wheat and land and dirt.
And on a scale that's much different, much smaller than we see today, nevertheless, it's the same lesson. People discover how interconnected the economy is and how money really works.
It's eerie, John, how similar it is to today. It's just because, you know, you think one small thing I was in Montana last week, and people were coming up to me in just the course of giving a couple talks and doing interviews and saying, I still don't understand this. I live out here in Montana, and I own my little business, or I have a ranch, or I have this piece of dirt. How could this thing be dragging me down? And it's the exact same parallel, the interconnectedness of it. And then the other story, of course, is the lack of regulation.
So, Tim, are you saying that we've learned nothing?
No, we learned something, because we did create FDIC. Roosevelt, when he took office in 1933, the very first thing he did was close the banks for 5 days. There was a bank holiday, as they called it, kind of a weird euphemism for closing the banks. And he was petrified because these run-on banks were still going on. And up to a third of all banks had already closed. And when the banks reopened, Roosevelt said, the government will back everybody's savings. They essentially created it. But he was BSing. He said later, sure, we saved capitalism, but if there had been a run, if people hadn't been confident, we never did have the money to support it. We were just saying we're putting the faith in credit. It was amazing to see these interviews later with him, because he did say, well, we pulled it off, and it was sort of a head fake.
Makes you want to ask Hank Paulson a few questions.
Yeah, no, exactly. So, I mean, the lesson, you know, Hoover didn't act for 3 years. He let the banks fail. So the lesson now is that Federal Reserve, the financial system, has acted very quickly. Whether this will save it or not, of course, no one knows. You look at what the market's done since the bailout, and it's tanked.
Right.
One more figure, which is fascinating. Remember I told you the 40% the great 1929 crash, the net result of that was 40% decline in the market value.
Right.
You know what the market's gone down this year, 2008? The S&P?
50.
It's very close to 40. It was 37 as of Monday morning before the 200-point loss. That's very, very similar.
Eerie. Finally, your book, The Worst Hard Time, tells a story of ultimately what was an environmental disaster, that reckless, greedy decisions on the part of a lot of Americans in a particular region of the United States caused soil erosion and an environmental catastrophe that was really something not really seen in the industrial era. Certainly, there's the same kind of commodity spike and crash going on with other kinds of things, like oil and coal. Do you see an environmental echo from those days?
I'll tell you where I see a little bit of that. It's in the run-up to ethanol, because you saw this huge competition for the same source, for both food and fuel. And so a lot of land that had been in soil conservation, this conservation reserve program which the government has, was taken out of it in this rush to do ethanol because the government's subsidizing it and setting these goals. The other thing is there's this depletion of this huge amount of water that underlies the Great Plains, and you see people using that right now. But I'm glad you brought this up, because the Dust Bowl was directly related to a commodities crash. It wasn't nature in any respect, any way, shape, or form. It was the soil had been stripped away, but because they couldn't sell the wheat, the land then blew. And so, again, the one thing I sort of see is ethanol. Now, what happens if oil continues to crash? I mean, what if it gets back down to $20 a barrel? All this rush to ethanol, all this corn that was planted in the last 2 years to meet this, you could see something similar happening there.
Hmm. Well, Tim Egan, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Timothy Egan writes the Outpost column for the New York Times. He won the 2006 National Book Award for his History of People Who Lived Through the Dust Bowl of the 30s. The book is The Worst Hard Time. And I got some ethanol left over from our Julian Moskin segment.
You sure do. I can smell it from here.
A little early.
It's a little early. We're always on, though, here at The Takeaway. On. 1 week from now, the election will be over. And for when the dust settles, we're considering slogans. How would you sum up the last year or two of campaigning?
My definition of a bad campaign is Barack Obama versus John McCain.
2 years of endless slogans.
Given the length of this whole primary process, this would have to be known as the long hello.
Black man becomes first nominee, war hero defeated by economy.
An historical moment in time.
Those are good.
Those are good. We want to hear your slogan. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we talked this hour with New York Times writer Julia Moskin about science and food. And our listener, Tom Holmes, wrote us to say, "Your discussion this morning about electrocuting hot dogs reminded me of a genuine product that my father brought home one time in the late 50s. It was called the Speedy Weenie." And it was invented by an engineer friend of his father's. Don't know if it was ever sold in stores, but we indeed had a working model in our kitchen. You put a raw hot dog between two poker-like metal prongs and turn on the electricity. Sizzle. Thanks very much,
Sounds
Tom,
like
for that.
Great for pledge drives, the Speedy Weenie with your pledge. If you missed anything, go on our website. You can find us on the iTunes podcast to go each morning. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
How do those industrious Obama workers do it?
Just keep swimming, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, swimming, swimming. What do we do?
The organized, historically disciplined Barack Obama campaign has invaded all 50 states, outspending and outorganizing everything in its path. Of candidates and juggernauts this morning, the Obama ground game is not underwater.
Swim, you want
See,
to
I'm going
to
get stuck now with that song. Now it's in my head.
Sorry.
It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 29th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Nemo. I mean, Adora.
I look so much like Nemo. Thanks for that. Sure. Today we're going to be looking at the campaign from the big picture and drilling down to bring you some interesting new angles. Plus, would America ever make a deal with the Taliban? You might be surprised at what's being reported, the beliefs by some top American commanders. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines, though.
Good morning, Adora. It's good enough for Thighmaster. It's good enough for Barack Obama. He's bought 30 minutes of network airtime to deliver an infomercial tonight just before the start or restart of the World Series. But wait, there's more. Not via infomercial. John McCain's got his pitch today.
Raising taxes makes a bad economy much worse. Keeping taxes low creates jobs, keeps money in your hands, and strengthens our economy.
McCain's going face-to-face and door-to-door in Florida today. Obama will be in Florida and North Carolina.
Overseas in Pakistan, officials fear that many are dead, thousands are homeless, and whole towns practically destroyed after a devastating 6.4 magnitude earthquake rocked the southwest. Local leaders say they're running low on food, medicine, and shelter for those who lost their homes. Elsewhere in Pakistan, the leadership is angry with the U.S. military. They told the U.S. today that they don't appreciate recent American missile strikes inside their territory. The missiles targeted militants in Pakistan's northwest.
Futures trading on U.S. indices show traders are betting on a basically flat open. This after yesterday's wild journey up. The Dow picked up 11% to close at 90.65. It's the second biggest point gain on record. The S&P was also up 11%, ending at 940. And we've got all kinds of confusing economic numbers this morning. Futures are pointing to a flat open, as I said, maybe slightly down. But manufacturing orders are posting their largest rise since June. It's unclear what that's about. The recession is, maybe not quite here yet.
The rest of Game 5 may be here of the World Series. It's set for tonight. That's weather permitting. Heavy rain forced the game on Monday to
be suspended.
To be suspended. And it was raining again last night, so there was no luck there. The Phillies lead the series 3 games to Tampa Bay's 1, so they can take the championship tonight if the game gets started and if they win.
And Barack Obama is going to delay it with his infomercials. We just mentioned 1 week from now, the election will be over, we hope, we believe. When the dust settles, we want you to come up with the slogan that defines the last 2 years of campaigning. Tell us in one sentence or a phrase how you'd sum up the race, something like, I can see change from my house, or Joe the plumber for president. You can do better than that. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also vote on slogans that have already been submitted on our website at mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. Perhaps there are a bit of glimmer of hope, for lack of a better word, in terms of the economy this morning. New numbers show that orders to U.S. factories for big-ticket items posted an unexpectedly strong showing in September thanks to a surge in demand for airplanes and autos. Also today, the Fed is expected to cut interest rates by at least a half percentage point, and those projected cuts are creating some market movement. Most European stock markets rose sharply today on
our
the heels of
national
yesterday's
nightmare is
huge
open.
Gains. Yeah. Well, that's why I said a glimmer of hope, but we're turning right now to Newsweek magazine's Dan Gross for his thoughts.
He's
on
the hope correspondent.
What the
Newsweek,
latest? Yeah. Are you the hope correspondent, Dan?
No, I'm the long national nightmare correspondent. The Hope correspondent has been, took the buyout, and we're hiring more long national nightmare reporters.
Excellent.
Okay, Dan. On a serious note, should we? Is there a bit of a hope here?
Well, I always measure progress by the absence of massive systemic failures. In other words, we got a few weeks without a major U.S. financial institution going down. I see that as a sign of progress. You have to stabilize before you can get back on the uptrend. So you know, I think the type of good news we should be looking for is more an absence of the types of, you know, really bad news we had all summer and the early fall. So I think these data points that you're getting in durable goods order, isolated earnings reports here and there, you know, that's nice, but I think the more important stuff is what we're not seeing. In other words, you know, massive bankruptcies, more financial institutions failing, and, you know, it's a sign that some of these bailouts and the psychological impact of them is actually working.
And what do you think about a surge in demand for airplanes and autos, not necessarily two things that we would immediately think would jump?
Well, I think, you know, with that number, the durable goods order, you always have to, I think, take the airline or the airplane data with a grain of salt, because those are such huge an airplane costs several hundred million dollars. So if Boeing gets one order this month for 50 planes and then next month doesn't get any, you know, you would have a wild disparity. So it's more important to look at the sort of long-term trend of that number rather than any single month's data.
Well, let's look forward to this half percentage point that the Federal Reserve is expected to cut the interest rate to. What would you expect that to result in?
Not a whole lot. You know, back in the 90s, there was this obsessive focus on Alan Greenspan and the Fed and this kind of binary assumption, you know, interest rates go down, stocks go up. And there was always this, you know, one of the hoariest slogans on Wall Street is, you know, you don't fight the Fed. When the Federal Reserve is cutting interest rates, that always tends to be good for stocks because it makes bonds less appealing as interest rates are lower. It makes money more available. And what do people do with that money? They buy stocks. You know, that's been part of the investor playbook for decades now. But in this past year, as we've seen with so many other things, the playbook has kind of gone out the window. The Federal Reserve has been cutting interest rates, taking the Fed funds rate from, I think, 5.25% down to 1.5% in 15 months. And, you know, the market has fought the Fed, right? We've had a meltdown of 30 or 40% amid this interest rate cutting campaign. So the old connection whereby this relationship between interest rates falling and stocks going up, I think, has certainly broken down. And I don't think we should hold too much stock.
I think your point is really well taken there, Dan. The playbook is out the window for everything. You got 10 seconds. You have a slogan for this presidential campaign that's coming to an end?
It's the stupid economy. really stupid decisions created the political terrain that will result in, you know, what should be a Democratic sweep.
Dan Gross, thank you, sir, as always. It's a pleasure. Dan
Anytime.
Gross, Newsweek columnist, who is our pal here at The Takeaway.
Long national nightmare correspondent. Anyway, some countries aren't waiting for the Fed to cut interest rates. The financial collapse has already had an effect on the quality of their currency and their ability to do business. Certain countries don't necessarily have confidence that their cash will work in this tough global economy. So trade is kind of returning to its roots. There are some examples of barter coming back in a big way. On Monday, Thailand, the world's largest exporter of rice, announced plans to barter rice for oil with the nation of Iran. And it won't be the only government-to-government bartering we see in the next coming months. Javier Blas wrote the story in the Financial Times. He explains this return to barter. Javier, what's going on with this Thai oil deal with Iran?
I think you explained perfectly. It's countries don't have access to credit, and governments are stepping in and try to replace the private sector doing government-to-government deals. And because there is a lack of trust in credit, in the financial transactions, some governments are just coming back to what trade was really at the beginning. I have this good, you have that good, let's just interchange the goods and no financial payment. So Thailand is discussing an agreement with Tehran used to ship rice in exchange of oil. That will be the payment.
I can understand, you know, trading a couple of sheep for a gun, but I'm wondering if this barter business actually scales to the level that, you know, we're talking about here, billions and billions of dollars.
I think that we are seeing signs that countries, in particular in West Africa and also in the Caribbean, are having a lot of difficulties to import food. And I will be not surprised that that's what officials and brokers are telling me, that we are going to see an increase of government-to-government deals where the government are going to guarantee the payment of the imports, but also an increase of bartering agreements. I think that in the early months of 2009 is going to become not as used the main source of trading, but something that is going to be hitting here and there.
You know, this might be an opportunity for companies like Cargill, which manage the infrastructure for trading kinds of commodities like this, to be an alternative to the brokerage and credit markets. Are you saying in this story that literally countries like Iran and Thailand are at risk of losing millions and millions of dollars even if they park their money in an account to pay for something like oil or rice for a few days, that the declines could be so precipitous that just parking the money could represent a loss in the transaction?
It's also not just the question of parking the money, is the lack of trust of, let's say, Thailand, of the letter of credit that is a common instrument for trading. From an Iranian bank, the Iranian bank will say, I'm going to pay to you, but then the Thailand government or a Thailand private sector exporter could look at that letter of credit and say, well, what is going to happen in 3 months for this bank? It's going to stay there. It's going to collapse. And that's when it's becoming a big, big problem. I was talking to a trader here in London that is one of the biggest traders in the rice market, and he was telling me that pre- this crisis, a letter of credit, the confirmation of a letter of credit, it used to cost between 1% and 125%, and used the traders and the banks were fighting for decimals. Now they have to pay triple or quadruple that amount, 3% to 4%.
So if you want to,
huge.
So if you want to use a letter of credit, you actually have to pay a 1% fee for that. And so nations like Iran are saying to nations of Thailand, you know, don't show me the money, show me the rice, or forget about it.
Exactly. That Thailand is saying, don't show me your money, don't show me a financial instrument. If you want the rice, send me oil. That's something that I could take. So we are back to what was the common way of trading maybe 100 or 200 years ago.
Outside of emerging markets like Thailand, where do you see this happening?
I don't see outside emerging markets. I think we have to go to emerging markets where the credit is a problem. But we have seen problems, for example, on grain exporters in the United States, soybean, corn, wheat, having problems where they are selling to emerging markets, that they have the deal and they have all the paperwork. But when they came to just finishing the deal, just interchange the financial instruments to make that deal good, the banks say, no way,
yeah.
This is too risky. So in a way, it's affecting rich countries, and in particular the U.S., but also Europe, when they are dealing with emerging markets.
Javier, last time we spoke, you mentioned something called the Baltic Cold Shipping Index, which is an indication of how boats filled with commodities are actually moving around the world. It was frozen back then. How's it doing today?
It's even more frozen, I will say. It's trading below 1,000 points. That means that we are back to the level that we were 6 years ago. And it's so low that some shippers, they said, look, it costs me more just run a ship, just pay the crew, pay for the fuel oil, that just I'm going to just anchor the ship on a port and just wait for better
just
times.
Park it and walk. Well, Javier Blas, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Javier Blas is a reporter for the Financial Times. He covers the commodities markets, talking about bartering arrangements, international, rice for oil, Thailand and Iran.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age. Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. You know, decades from now, many decades from now, your kids are going to ask you, you know, what was it like back in 2008? And you're going to need a slogan to describe what went on during the historic campaign of 2008.
Is that right?
So as a public service, we are soliciting a slogan for the last campaign. We want to hear how you would define this last 2 years of campaigning.
This is Judith from Manhattan. I think this year's election is pitch perfect versus tone deaf.
877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. A slogan for this historic campaign.
And they're coming up with some good ones, our listeners are. This campaign is historic on many levels. The first African-American atop a Democratic ticket, the first woman running mate in the Republican ticket. And should Barack Obama win, the way that he did it also will be historic. He's raised more money than any other candidate in any presidential campaign. And he set up an unprecedented voter registration and get out the vote organization. Marshall Gantz, a Harvard professor and community organizer who worked with Cesar Chavez and Bobby Kennedy, has been at the heart, training hundreds of organizers and volunteers, galvanizing people across the country at what they call Camp Obama. Professor Gantz joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's your slogan, Professor?
Oh, my slogan. My friend Tom Hayden once said, change is slow except when it's fast. And it was slow for a while, but now it's fast.
Now it's fast. How would you sum up the strategy of organizing all of these volunteers?
Well, I think that for the first time in many, many years, a campaign has really done organizing, which means recruiting, identifying, developing leadership, building community around that leadership, and building power, capacity from the resources of the community. Most campaigning has become a marketing game, one form of advertising or another, where voters are turned into consumers and, you know, urged to buy, you know, product A or, you know, box A or box B, which is the opposite of organizing, which is engaging people as citizens, as people who participate in, take part in, work with one another to achieve a common purpose. And that's what they did. They really, in a way, got back to probably the most traditional way that Americans have made social change in this country since the beginning.
Let's look at some of the numbers. 700 offices in more than a dozen battleground states, several thousand organizers managing tens of thousands of volunteers. And you say the heart of that is this, it's not just Barack Obama, but it's this notion of a community and values.
Yeah, well, it's organizing people to work together, recognizing that people will make commitments of their time, energy, and effort if it's something they really care about. And so it's rooted in a values approach. Instead of trying to mobilize people around this issue or that issue, which is often can be pretty divisive, it's getting down to the core values that actually bring people together, like commitments to justice, to equality, to hopefulness. A lot of this stuff that, you know, in the beginning of the campaign, people talked about Barack being sort of, you know, it was fluffy and all that. Well, he was speaking the language of moral leadership is what he was doing. And for the first time, a Democrat did that in many, many years, and it connected with people. So then the question was how to turn that motivation into structured outcomes.
How would you say it's different from the organization that Republicans have been so successful with since, you know, the Reagan victories in the 1980s?
Well, I think the key to understanding the Republican deal is that it was also rooted in a movement, the conservative movement. And the conservative movement was rooted in certain moral commitments and through local churches, gun clubs, and so forth. And so they had that foundation on which to build of committed people. And then they structured it skillfully and you know, used it well electorally. The Democrats sort of abandoned that base years ago and just began doing policy talk and doing issue talk and forgot that what moves people, again, is the values that are at our core. And so they became disconnected from local organizing and disconnected from that kind of approach to politics. Now, so one of the things that we have trained people to do is how to appreciate the sources of motivation in their own stories and in their own experience and build on that to engage others, which is exactly what Barack does at a national level.
So, exactly. Explain to us, what happens at Camp Obama?
Well, there have been lots of different versions of Camp Obama, and there's been many of them. But the basic idea is this. The basic idea is that people come together, individuals come together. They are formed into leadership teams, and the teams are organized by geographical, locale. They learn how to tell their stories, what we call a public narrative, why they're there and why we're there. They learn to do one-on-one relationship building with one another to discern common interests. They learn how to structure themselves in terms of roles and responsibilities. They learn to strategize. They learn the tactics of political organizing. And they leave with a goal for their area, their community that they've committed to, and they've, in many cases, often already done the work to get people committed to come to their first meeting.
Is there a camp song?
No camp song. Sorry.
Okay, Professor.
But the idea is launching organized teams, and so that's what it is.
Okay, Professor. We thank you for joining us.
Okay.
Professor Marshall Gantz, a Harvard professor and community organizer who's been involved in Camp Obama. Now we turn to Femi Okeh, who is involved with the latest headlines.
Very involved, very attached to them, in fact. 28 minutes past the hour. Good morning. The U.S. markets open in just a few minutes after gaining 11% yesterday. The Dow is set to open flat. Hungary is about to receive a multi-billion dollar rescue package. The IMF, the EU, and the World Bank will provide more than $25 billion to boost the country's wilting economy. Hungary's currency and stock market was hit hard by worries about the country's large international debt, but today at the news, the stock market and the currency have made a recovery. A Guantanamo Bay detainee's confession is being thrown out. A U.S. military judge ruled yesterday that the confession of Mohammed Jawad is inadmissible because it had been obtained through torture. He's accused of injuring two U.S. soldiers with a hand grenade in 2002. The planet's headed for an ecological credit crunch. That's according to a study led by the World Wildlife Fund. They say that we're using natural resources at way too fast a pace for the planet to sustain. The US and China are the biggest drains. They account for almost half of the ecological footprint. And finally, to the Halloween decorations that are so scary, the Secret Service dropped by to investigate. Agents checked out a California home which featured a mannequin of Sarah Palin hanging from a noose and John McCain stuffed down a chimney with flames coming around him. The mayor says it's a hate crime. Special agents say it's just unusual.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Looks like a calm opening on Wall Street as the markets have just opened a moment ago. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down just a slight fraction. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that apparently the U.S. government may be considering some change of strategy in Afghanistan, possibly even a dialogue with the Taliban. Yesterday, White House spokeswoman Dana Perino discussed the matter with reporters.
We realize that we have to try to reconcile some of these groups. But whether or not some elements of the Taliban would renounce violence and extremism and work for the greater good of Afghanistan remains to be seen.
Does reconciliation mean direct engagement with the Taliban? It's something that reportedly, at least according to the Wall Street Journal, David Petraeus, the commander of CENTCOM, actually supports. But with plenty of experience dealing with the Taliban, we turn for some answers to former permanent representative to the United Nations from Pakistan, Ambassador Munir Akram. He joins us from Geneva. Ambassador, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be with you again.
In your experience, what is the value of directly engaging the Taliban in dialogue?
I think that if one has to bring the war in Afghanistan to an end,
you would have to negotiate with the people who are engaged in that war. There are two basic parties. One is the Al-Qaeda. You cannot negotiate with them. That's the objective of the war. But the Taliban are a collateral enemy. And in order to bring peace to Afghanistan, I think that we will have to negotiate and to reach some arrangement with the Taliban to stabilize Afghanistan.
In your experience, when negotiations have taken place between parties and the Taliban, how open are they to discussing security issues? Or, you know, what is the agenda that you typically find?
Well, of course, they have their own agenda. They were in power and they were ousted by the U.S. intervention. So obviously, they want power, or they want to share in power, especially in the South and Southeast. Obviously, they would want to resume some sort of position of power and authority. At the same time, they know that they cannot win against major coalition forces or Pakistani forces, and they will therefore have to compromise. There are five distinct command centers for the Taliban, at least they were for until a year and a half ago. And one could try to negotiate with those separate command centers, but one has to open the negotiations with an open mind, not with preconditions that we know would not be acceptable to the other side.
Ambassador, do you believe this Wall Street Journal story?
Well, you know, yesterday, the Jirga, which is meeting in Islamabad, the Afghan-Pakistan Jirga, has called for talks with the Taliban. And I think that this obviously could not have been done without some sort of coordination with Washington. So there is movement. I don't know whether the movement towards dialogue is sufficient or a genuine movement, but there, apparently there seems to be a review of policy, and it's a good thing there's a review of policy. I believe that there should be a comprehensive review and revision of policy to succeed in Afghanistan and in Pakistan.
Ambassador, we've heard experts make a distinction between Pakistani Taliban, Afghan Taliban. Is it clear who is the Taliban and who represents the leadership?
Precisely. I think that one has to analyze the whole Taliban movement in order to understand who's who and who one has to deal with where. To my information, there are five command centers within Afghanistan. Mullah Omar is one of them, Jalaluddin Haqqani, and there are three others that have different locales of power in southern and eastern Afghanistan. On the Pakistani side, there are militant movements who are sympathetic to, who have ideological association with the Taliban, but did not arise from the Taliban. They have separate genesis and separate modus operandi. But they have begun to coalesce now under what is called the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. But they are distinct from the Taliban in Afghanistan. So one has to understand each of these movements when we are talking to them, negotiating with them, to understand how far to go and what kind of arrangements we can make with each one of them.
There is historical precedent, Mr. Ambassador, for nations having contacts with intermediaries and parties in the middle of a presidential campaign. We certainly saw that in the hostage situation during the Carter administration, the waning days of the Carter administration. You called for a complete review of U.S.-Afghanistan policy on this program a little more than a week ago. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have any information as to whether officials in the Pakistan government are in touch with members of the Barack Obama campaign or the John McCain campaign?
Well, I'm sure that our ambassador in Washington and our authorities in Islamabad must be conveying our thoughts to both campaigns. I'm sure that we would be remiss if we did not do so.
But would you say active discussions are underway with the Barack Obama campaign?
I would perhaps not go so far. Because, as you know, Mr. Obama has made certain statements which have caused concern in Pakistan. But we certainly need to talk to the campaign of Mr. Obama. And
I think it's more necessary to talk to him than with the other campaign.
Well, you must have said something wrong because your government's on the line.
I am fortunately not answerable to my government anymore.
Former permanent representative to the United Nations from Pakistan, Ambassador Munir Akram, thanks for speaking to us from Geneva. And now we have some headlines from Femi. Okay, with the markets open.
Yes, how are the markets doing? Can you see? I can't
fractionally
see
down.
Now.
No big deal.
Okay, thank you very much. The time is 20 minutes to the top of the hour. In other news, Pakistan's foreign ministry has called for an immediate stop to U.S. missile strikes, in its border region. They say the attacks violate its sovereignty and antagonize extremists. American commanders say the Pakistani military hasn't been putting enough pressure on its militant enclaves. Pakistan has also been devastated by earthquakes this morning, two so far today in southwest Pakistan. No immediate reports of casualties from the most recent tremor, which measured 6.2 on the Richter scale. The earlier quake was only slightly stronger and it left 160 people dead and thousands homeless. Now, you have to file this one under bad luck. After being injured for all of his rookie season in 2007, the number one pick, Greg Oden, played all of 13 minutes for the Portland Trailblazers in last night's NBA season opener.
Sprained his foot, right?
Before limping off the court, yeah. This is what Oden says happened to him.
I think it was a hook shot. Just went up to go get the offensive rebound, came down on Derek Fisher's foot, kind of on the side of his foot and rolled.
Sounds a bit sheepish there, doesn't he? He will get an MRI today and to determine the damage, and he's yet to score a point in his NBA career that many thought would be a great one. Maybe it's just a slow starter.
It must be miserable to have all those millions in the bank and not have scored a point.
Shame. And, yeah. and finally, a bit of sports news. Senator McCain says that when I'm president, no one will delay the start of the World Series with an infomercial. That's because tonight's game will be interrupted just a little bit by Barack Obama's infomercial.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. Less than 1 week left in that campaign, exactly 6 days, and both men, both presidential candidates, are claiming victory.
We are 1 week away from bringing change to Virginia and bringing change to America.
It's wonderful to be back in Pennsylvania, and it's wonderful to fool the pundits because we're going to win the state of Pennsylvania.
Republican presidential nominee John McCain stressed his day one readiness to be commander-in-chief in North Carolina and Pennsylvania yesterday. At a rally, McCain's running mate Sarah Palin said the Republicans will, quote, fool the pundits with an upset win on Election Day. Meanwhile, tonight will be a major TV play for Barack Obama. He's planning a 30-minute commercial that will be running on all major broadcast networks except for ABC. It'll also run on several cable outlets. Joining us now to talk about all of this is Takeaway Political Director Andrea Bernstein. Good morning, Andrea.
Good morning, Adora. Greetings from Gate 11 on my way to West Palm Beach.
Oh, just the way we like it, Andrea, out there on the road. What do you make of this infomercial that Barack Obama is set to run tonight?
It's kind of a stunning turn of events that he even has the money to be playing around with at this stage of the game. Normally what you'd be doing is struggling to target ads in key swing states. But it's all part of the Barack Obama phenomenon. I mean, when he was a senator, he sold this book, and it became a bestseller. And then he sort of became the stealth candidate of the primary. No one thought he could win, and he won. And now here he is in the last week of the campaign in this very strong position where he has millions and millions of dollars to spend on network television right before the resuming fifth inning of the World Series.
Do you think there's any chance of it perhaps backfiring? I mean, at a certain point, does he reach a point of diminishing return?
Well, the McCain campaign is certainly hoping so. And they've just put out an ad this morning mocking the infomercial and saying that what it masks, what all the glitz and the big rallies mask, is that Obama doesn't really understand how to run a government. But what I can certainly find out in the trail is a hunger for details on the part of voters. And the more the better. So having a network television broadcast where you talk about what you're going to do for the country doesn't seem like such a bad thing in this environment.
Let's talk about McCain and Palin. Palin's in Ohio today, McCain in Florida. Florida polls, the latest one, showing that Barack Obama may be picking up some support there.
Yeah, you know, I mean, everybody, you know, is working on Florida. McCain and Obama are there today. Bill Clinton's going to be there with Obama in their first joint appearance ever of this campaign, sort of a coming full circle. McCain's going to Florida where he won the Florida primary and essentially the nomination. I think the problem for John McCain and the struggle that he's had in this campaign is that he played the role of Luke Skywalker flawlessly. He's not such a great Darth Vader. And it's been a struggle for him to convince people that he inhabits the Death Star in a strong way, and that's sort of where he finds himself 6 days out.
How is he as a Wookiee?
I don't know who the Wookiee is. Maybe David Axelrod, Steve Schmidt.
Well, Andrea, we're going to let you get to your flight there at Gate 11 on your way to Florida, and we'll look forward to your reports.
Okay,
safe
we'll
travels.
Talk to you tomorrow.
That's Andrea Bernstein, our Takeaway political director, heading to Florida, where the campaigns, both of them, spending many hours in these waning days.
Very much on duty in West Palm.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, October 29th. Emmy Oke has just joined us with the latest headlines.
Thank you very much, Adora. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour, and the Dow is down about 25 points so far. Now, it's hard to believe, but there's just under a week to go before campaign 2008 is over. John McCain's campaign's in Florida today. Barack Obama will be there as well as being in North Carolina. Now, Senator Obama's campaign will dominate primetime television tonight. His multi-million dollar ad buyout will pay for a 30-minute campaign infomercial on most major networks. The only one it won't be on will be ABC.
With the kind of ratings he gets, he should sell commercials during that infomercial.
There's going to be a little
interruption.
So you
can make money for the campaign.
There's going to be a little interruption. Really? There'll be a live feed into a rally with former President Clinton in it as well. So there will be a little extra.
Clinton bought a commercial. Bill Clinton bought a commercial.
Don't forget who I am. Anyway, meanwhile, the fighting in Congo is getting more intense as the rebels advance on the eastern city of Goma. The UN peacekeeping force, known as MONUC, has pledged to defend civilians being threatened by the fighting. Michel Bonadeau is a MONUC spokesman.
The fact that rebels are now 20 kilometers just north of Goma is a factor that is increasing fear, increasing tensions, and the population is requesting, you know, strong armed intervention by MONUC on the side of the Congolese army, and that's precisely what's happening.
The Congolese army claims that fighters from neighboring Rwanda are joining the fight. They say Rwanda is helping rebels bent on toppling the government. Rwanda denies this, and UN officials back them up. They say they haven't seen any evidence to support that accusation. And staying in Africa, there's been a wave of 5 suicide bombings across Somalia. Targets included a UN compound there. And Somalia has been unstable since the early 90s. Clashing warlords, famine and poverty haunt the country. That's a look at some of the major stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. Extra read all about it. In Crisis, A Hunt for Culprits. It's the headline on the front of the Christian Science Monitor. But I printed it off of my printer, the Monitor, to look at it this morning. There's also a story about U.S.-Pakistani cooperation. I've got paper, but I printed it myself, which is part of the reason why we're talking to John Yema, who's the editor of the Christian Science Monitor. He's on the phone from the editorial offices of the CSM in Boston. John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Is it a self-fulfilling prophecy that I printed out the front page of the Christian Science Monitor the day after you announced that the Monitor will cease publication as a newspaper, or at least as a daily newspaper?
No, I don't think so. I think that probably you've been looking at it online as everybody else has been looking at it online and printing it out and not buying the paper copy, as the Monitor only has a circulation of about 50,000 right now. So, you know, we've been getting out of the newspaper business for quite a long time because people have been migrating to the web.
Subscribe to the Monitor's treeless edition you advertise for only $8 a month. Let's get out of the sort of new media story here for a moment. I mean, I know that's really the motivation here, but sure. You know, in some ways the Christian Science Monitor was started 100 years ago as an impulse to counter the kind of crazy media chaos in the Hearst era of newspapers. What was that mission as you understand it, looking back a century?
Well, you know, it may sound corny to people, sort of hard-bitten journalists, and I've been a hard-bitten journalist, but the founding motto was to injure no man but to bless all mankind. And, you know, in the newsroom of the Monitor, even to this day, people talk about that like they're looking at a photo or they're looking at a story and they're going, is this a little too snarky? Should we choose a different kind of photo? The whole point is to try to create this respectable news source that is unbiased and doesn't have an axe to grind. It is non-sensationalistic. That starts in 1908 during an era of yellow journalism, goes through 100 years. We're 100 years later. Actually, we celebrate our 100th anniversary next month. But, you know, that world that it launched into is very much a world that exists now on the Internet, and we'd like to turn our time and attention more to sort of being a standard on the Internet for sound, safe, you know, sober journalism.
You were essentially quoting Mary Baker Eddy there, weren't you? The founder of the newspaper. And in a sense, perhaps you're ceasing the paper edition is really more of a beginning than an ending. Really?
I think that's a good point, Adora. I mean, the newspaper, you know, the physical process of producing a newspaper really hamstrings a lot of the journalism that we do. You know, we've got noon deadlines, for instance. So that means from noon until, you know, 6 the next morning or even later, because we deliver ourselves by the U.S. Postal Service, we're sort of blind to the news. You know, getting rid of a lot of that physical infrastructure, the whole baggage train of the print process, and being able to go immediately, sort of like you guys do on radio, immediately to people is, I think, what will make csmonitor.com, our website, a much more vital website now.
You know, you describe on the front page of the paper today that the Democrats are potentially going to sweep into Washington, and you know, you've got political coverage that's not unlike other newspapers. What advantages did the Christian Science Monitor have editorially that you believe you're going to be taking into the Internet era?
Well, the main advantage is that we are a nonprofit. We have one great benefactor, and that's the Christian Science Church, which, you know, has given us this mission of doing great journalism. There's one religious article in the Monitor, and that's it. So the advantage is that we're not sort of desperately seeking to keep our profits going, and we can kind of keep our standards pretty high. We do need to be self-sustaining, you know, so that we can continue that mission into the new century. And the kind of journalism we do tries to get behind the headlines to try to understand why things are happening, and especially overseas, but in the political world, we do that too.
John, you know, I have a little news for you. You know, a lot of the newspaper businesses are nonprofit at this point in their era. You actually share that with a number of them. As a foreign correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, though, and I've you know, worked with a lot of your colleagues all around the world in my early days in radio. How were you received as a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor? Say, if you met a world mm-hmm. leader.
Well, you know, the Monitor has a reputation that actually exceeds its reach, and it's amazing the kind of people, even world leaders, know about us. Many of them have gone to school, you know, in Boston or Cambridge, and they've read the Monitor. They know of the Monitor by reputation, or possibly their press aides know about it. But you know what's amazing is you get into a cab. I was a foreign correspondent in the Middle East. You get into a cab in Cairo, and you say that you're with the Christian Science Monitor, and you almost always hear them say, well, oh, that's a wonderful newspaper. I've never read it. So it has this reputation, and I think that reputation
like,
is because...
That's why we're in trouble now.
Ouch.
Could be.
Ouch.
But you know, well, the Kyrene cab driver is not our normal market.
I know.
Right, exactly. You know, I was a subscriber to the... my parents gave it to me as a gift when I was in sixth grade, and it was an amazing opening of a window to the world for me that really has never closed throughout my entire career. And, you know, quite frankly, I'm going to miss the paper, even though I haven't laid eyes on it probably in a couple of years. But still, there's something about that object, that paper, as a platform to transport a young reader into understanding all kinds of things going on in the globe. I'll be nostalgic for its loss.
You know, I totally agree with you that print is a wonderful medium. You know, we will still have a weekly print edition. It'll be about 44 pages, come out on the weekend. It'll be, you know, that's the kind of thing that you can sit down with and pour a cup of coffee and read. Now, not having that on a daily basis, yeah, that'll be a loss, especially to some people. But we think that seeing it online, or we have an email, a three-page PDF email news summary that we'll be doing too. So amongst those three types of editions, I think we'll find something that'll, you know, kind of make you remember your childhood, John.
Well, and without those noon deadlines, I guess you guys can take long lunches and really sort of hang out there in Boston. John Yemeth, thanks so much for joining us, editor at the Christian Science Monitor, talking about how the Monitor is ceasing publication as a daily paper and going online with a weekly paper edition. Thanks for joining us, John.
You're very welcome.
So we're always on.
We're always on at the Takeaway.
We don't have a paper edition.
No,
and we're
nonprofit. We could if you print us out from our website,
that's right?
That would be a self-fulfilling prophecy, as you said. Anyhow, 1 week from today, the election will be over, and we're thinking about slogans to sum up the almost 2 years of presidential campaigning. What would you come up with?
Pitch perfect versus tone deaf.
Hope versus be afraid. Be very, very afraid.
Kind of mavericky.
Mental root canal.
It's the stupid economy.
My friend Tom Hayden once said, change is slow except when it's fast. And it was slow for a while, but now it's fast.
Those are great, you guys. Just one sentence or phrase. Come on. You can come up with something even better. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And you can vote on your favorite slogan at vote2008.thetakeaway.org. Pick your favorite, and we're adding your ideas as they roll in.
And here's your takeaway for today.
I always measure progress by the absence of massive systemic failures.
That's Newsweek's Dan Gross. If you missed anything, it's all on our website at thetakeaway.org. You can also take your podcast to go on iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. It's The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.